And I'm Elizabeth.
And we're so happy to be here today talking to you all about abolition. Elizabeth and I spend a lot of our time, pretty much every morning, talking and reading and ranting and hoping for abolition. Abolishing the police, abolishing prisons, and abolishing a lot of the racist harms of the legal system around us. And this conversation's gone pretty mainstream as of late. Maryam Kaba, a thought leader on this issue, was on a podcast in conversation with Chris Hayes last month. The New York Times, out of all the publications, did a profile of Ruth Wilson Gilmore, asking if prisons are even necessary. And even here at the law school, we've been spending a lot of time in the last few weeks talking about abolition. The Harvard Law Review dedicated its annual April issue around developments in the law to prison abolition just this past month, and had a symposium on campus where our guest today spoke at and wrote the issue. And that symposium was followed by the first ever critical race theory conference on campus, which was truly phenomenal, and also ended up being a de facto space for talking about abolishing a pretty racist and classist legal system. So it's exciting for us to carry that conversation onto our podcast today. Elizabeth, you're not just at the law school. You've got a whole PhD you're working on this thing. Do you want to give us some context for our conversation?
Yeah, sure. Actually, I came into my PhD research, which looks at different factors in the rise of mass incarceration, wanting to know how we went from a country that in the early 70s had under 200,000 people locked up to now holding more than 2 million people in thousands of federal and state prisons, local jails, and detention facilities. Now, admittedly, the reasons for this growth are complex, but one thing in my research that I found is certain is that mass incarceration is not here because of some type of mass inherent criminality or moral failings on the part of the people that are getting locked up. Instead, I came to see that in order to understand the history of the United States and of the rise of mass incarceration, you have to first acknowledge that mass incarceration must be situated within a longer American project that's rooted in racial and class oppression and white supremacy, that slavery and the near extinction of Native people was followed by convict leasing. We had Jim Crow. Now we have mass incarceration, and racial and class disparities persist in nearly every facet of American life, in educational access and attainment, employment and unemployment, housing, health outcomes, arrest, imprisonment rates, and others. So knowing this history is one of the primary factors in how I came to identify as a prison abolitionist, a label that even just a few short years ago, I would have been hesitant to embrace. So that brings me to ask you, how did you come to identifying as an abolitionist?
Yeah, I know that we spent some time in the last few weeks trying to figure out pinpoint when we started using that word. And I can't really come up with a moment. What I do know is that I've spent a lot of time over the last few years, and I actually get kind of emotional, so I'm trying not to trip up over this, but I want to live in a world where I have 5 younger siblings and I don't want them to experience the sexual violence me and my friends did. Like, I want to live in a world without that sort of harm or any others. And I know all too well that the police and the prison system aren't equipped to address it. So I've spent the last few years organizing with survivors. And everywhere we turn, it's like clear that the police and prisons don't work. In DC, which is a majority black city, of women who experience abusive relationships who have called the police, the overwhelming majority say they would actually never call the cops again, both because the cops themselves ended up hurting these women, or the cops did things in that situation that made abuse much more likely or much more violent. The prison system's also really racist. When I was in high school and thinking about reporting, I wasn't going to go to the very cops who were out here surveilling my mosque, right? And lots of people of color, women of color, queer people of color, like, there, it just doesn't make sense to go to the very place that's hurting you in so many other ways to address sexual harm. And also, like, even if we were to, like, even if we could somehow get all rapists into prison, it's clear that prisons just don't work. It doesn't make sense that sending people, particularly men when we're talking about sexual harm, into a space where they themselves are sexually victimized, witness, like, horrific kinds of violence, or cope with trauma by, like, perpetrating violence, would then come out and suddenly be better and be better equipped to treat people around them with care and accountability. Like, prisons aren't getting us out of this issue, and we just desperately need other responses. And watching the ways in which the state pours all of its money into locking people up rather than doing truly anything on the front end to have healthy relationship education, to address poverty, to address, like, other root causes of violence, has pushed me far enough to know that, like, we need other solutions. And that's what abolition is to me, is trying to imagine the world as we want it. And in that world, we don't have cages full of rape to address the way people hurt each other.
Absolutely.
Elizabeth, I know that our guest today has also played a huge part in your thinking. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that and introduce him?
Yes, definitely. Our guest today is Angel Sanchez, who's a 2L at University of Miami Law School. This is Angel's first time as a guest on the CRCL podcast, but you can read about his work last year to pass Amendment 4 in Florida, which restored voting rights to people with felony convictions. That's on our website. And in his piece for the Harvard Law Review in the April issue, he writes about his own journey through the school-to-prison pipeline and his experience of going from serving 12 years in prison to now being a law student, a dedicated advocate, and a tremendous scholar. And in addition to learning more about the history of mass incarceration and the ways imprisonment fails both survivors and those being incarcerated, as you just said, the conversations that I had with Angel did indeed play an instrumental role in shaping my own thinking on abolition. So, Angel, welcome. Angel, can you start by telling us a little bit more about yourself and about your work?
Yeah, certainly. Thank you, Beth, and thank you, Mahro, for having me on. I want to tell you, Beth, as much as you say I'm part of the reason that you got into abolition work, I probably was doing this work but did not identify as an abolitionist or even understood the entire paradigm. And I picked up a lot of that from you, so it's been reciprocal. So thank you for that. A lot of the work that I'm doing down here and is part of the directly impacted community here in Florida is voting rights restoration, giving a political voice for those who have been disenfranchised, largely as a result of Jim Crow era laws that have persisted here in Florida. I have the privilege of going back into the prison and working with some of the men there, teaching them legal writing and hopefully getting them to a place where they could produce academic literature and provide insights from within the prison, which is something that I've come to value a lot, which is having the narratives, the voices, and the literature from people that are directly impacted. It's one thing to be talking about prisons. It's another thing to be talking to the people that are experiencing it. It gives us insights. It allows us to see their humanity, their potential, and also to be considerate of what we, to be sensitive to what we might think is better for them. It's important to be listening to them. But I'm excited to be here and talk about some of this work and hopefully also clarify for some of the listeners what abolitionist work looks like. Oftentimes it's categorized as something radical and it pushes people away. But people will be surprised to find out that they're more in line with an abolitionist framework than they would be led to believe.
We've said that to a few people, including our criminal law professor this week. Verdict's out on whether he's actually an abolitionist. So, Angel, I know that you've talked about, like, like evolving in your own journey towards using the term abolition. Could you tell us a little bit about how you've developed your political commitments and your views of the criminal legal system?
Yeah. Actually, you know, one of the things that I think grounds much of my work, my ideology, and my politics is centralizing the humanity of those that are marginalized, that have been oppressed, that continue to be oppressed, and that suffer state violence. And I say that all in very big words, but in sum is that I wanted to help people that have been hurt or that are hurting. And oftentimes, the ones that I could relate to the most were the ones that are hurting because of the same violence that I suffered or that come from the same experiences that I come from. And so, you know, trying to find ways to help people that are still stuck in the world that I arguably in some ways have been able to escape has actually shaped my work and the things that I want to do. And so that means going back into the prisons, helping people that are getting out of prisons, seeing children who are children of incarcerated parents, trying to overcome the statistics that they will probably end up in incarceration, trying to produce and, I mean, provide and promote education for those that are incarcerated so that they could have what I call autonomy of the mind and free themselves from this learned helplessness that the state has led us to believe that we are the worst of the worst, the scum of the earth, and can do no better. All those things together lead me to everything that I do. And when I then go into a theoretical framework and ask, well, what framework fits into this? And it would obviously be an abolitionist framework, a framework that opposes state violence, but at bottom, it is a framework that focuses on the humanity of every individual, particularly those that we've been told are others or that don't count or who have been hidden from us so that we don't think about them. And I think that's one of the things that prison does. It tells you that those labeled by it are evildoers and then hides the inhumane treatment of those people. And so my work is to undo that and reverse that.
Well, Angel, I've said this to you before too, but I'm just really grateful for your vulnerability. And I'm sorry that you've had these experiences and so many others have and feel compelled to share them with the world in order to make it a little less violent. But your writing is very powerful and so is the work that you do. I just wanted to go back to the first question around your commitments and ask one more follow-up. I think I'm realizing that some readers might hear what you've written or are saying and just say that, like, oh, we, like, also think that, like, we have too many people locked up or, like, prisons shouldn't look like this, but might not understand how to go from that to, like, oh, policing and prisons as they exist altogether are racist or classist and just, like, we don't need any of them. Could you just walk us through that jump for people who, like, might hear that, like, mass incarceration is wrong but don't totally see why that critique means jumping to, like, a totally abolitionist framework?
Right. Well, the first thing that I encourage most listeners to think about is the fact that no one wakes up and says, I'm going to prison today. And I mean that like saying, I'm going to pack my bags and walk to a prison or to a jail and ask them, hey, can you let me come in and stay there for a while? No one really does that. But individuals do may wake up one day and say, today I'm committing a crime. But that individual did not wake up and say, I'm going to commit a crime. And in fact, it didn't arrive at that level that morning. And so the question that we ask is a deeper question is, how come? Where did this begin? And so for many individuals, and I, that's one of the reasons that I wrote my piece the way I wrote it, was to show how it is an incremental, step-by-step, almost hurting and leading of an individual from a school system that is labeled a troubled school with an oppressive and carceral approach to treating juveniles, to eventually landing them in a juvenile system that desensitizes them, and a system that views the carceral system as a response to juvenile behavior, to then making prison the logical extension of that.
One of the things that you mentioned is young people, and it just made me think that the criminal system really rests on this idea that there are good people and bad people, right? And nowhere is that like myth so obviously wrong than I think when it comes to young people, where we have to admit that perpetrators of harm are also usually its victims. A few folks at the symposium mentioned this line from Danielle Sered's new book, Until We Reckon, where she writes, "No one enters violence for the first time committing it." And much of your piece, Angel, maps out the ways in which the police and ghettoized schools themselves like created the very youth they with like long-standing trauma who would then end up being criminalized. Could you talk a little bit about pushing back on the idea that perpetrators are just born perpetrators, and a little bit more about these pipelines of trauma?
Yeah, so in fact, Bruce Western, when he did his research in Boston, one of the things that they learned was that those individuals that were coming out of prison and experiencing the so-called reentry, particularly the ones that had violent crimes, all of them had, prior to the commission of a violent crime, had also been witnesses to violent crimes and were victims of violent crimes. And there was actually no order to the process. A lot of times they switched hats, and it wasn't like at one point there were witnesses, at another point there were victims, and then ultimately they were now perpetrators permanently. In fact, they seemed to go and switch different hats in different circumstances. And a lot of that is concentrated poverty and ghettoized communities. And then what happens when you send individuals to prison is that you concentrate those problems and that poverty into an even more violent institution. And then they experience violence, suffer violence, perpetrate violence, and witness violence. And so all three of those things I experienced personally. And that's one of the reasons that I take a reader through the entire journey, so that we don't have this siloed, bracketed view of an individual. Because if we only have that view, then it will rationalize and justify our conscience in treating them like the worst of the worst. The other thing that I think it's important to keep in mind is that a lot of times we're just focusing on the perpetrator and the crime that was committed. But I think one of the beautiful things about an abolitionist framework is that it actually focuses on the victim, on restoring the community. And so when we think of someone that commits some harm, our response is, what do we do to that person? And arguably, how much harm can we now perpetrate upon that person? As opposed to, how can we restore the person that was harmed? And our current system right now ignores the victim and just thinks about how can we ratchet up the harm in a civilized way against the person who committed the harm. How can we do that if we don't think the victim is valuable? And if we don't think that the perpetrator was once a victim, and that the perpetrator themselves are not valuable. So at the heart of all this is not seeing the humanity in either, and just vying for the control of power and maintaining a power that is necessary for what some would say is for order. And so an abolitionist would ask not only what harm did this person commit, but what happened to the harmed person? Was that person made better? Because as we are now speaking, there is a continuum. That person that was harmed and not taken care of may eventually harm someone else or harm themselves. And our community is not better for it. And so not only should we recognize that individuals who commit harm have also been victims of harm, but we should also be focusing on systems that restore those that are harmed.
Angel, something that you said on campus earlier this month that really made both of us stop short was we can imagine the end of the world before we can imagine the end of prisons. It made me think about how the criminal system and punitive responses to harm have become such a monopoly on our minds, even as advocates and abolitionists. So can you talk a little bit about that and also about what you called reformist reforms and how we should be wary of those?
Yeah, so I'm going to use an analogy right now that might communicate this, and it's a little lighthearted analogy, but I believe we've watched enough movies that have shown the end of the world about to happen. We haven't watched probably any movie that has shown us how a society without prisons can operate. And so I say that jokingly, but there is a lot of truth to it, and it's the power of media. And Angela Davis talks about how media serves to perpetuate the systems we have. And so when I say we could imagine the end of the world, but we can't imagine the end of prison, partly I'm saying that is because we have actually been given images of what the end of the world could look like, but we have never been given images of what the end of prisons looks like. And so because of that, I think it's that we have a limit on our imagination because we haven't gone and created those images for ourselves. We haven't highlighted the alternatives. So that's one of the reasons I think we're in that space. And I think the more we create alternatives, the more we show individuals and people start seeing that there are better alternatives, the more we will start normalizing it and seeing it as a possibility and inevitably start thinking of it as a reality and can imagine it even more than we could imagine the end of the world. As far as what does reformist reform looks like, so a lot of times people think of prison abolition as a group to be aligned with, as opposed to a worldview or a paradigm that one uses to confront the injustices that surrounds them, right? So I think it's more of a compass for me on how I approach things, as opposed to I'm on the side of the abolitionist group as a party. And so the example that I could think about right now, it's recently there is a bill in the Florida Senate that is being passed by some conservatives that seeks to provide some relief to the injustices of our justice or our legal system, if you will. And in it, it seeks to increase the threshold of how much it would take for someone to be a felon if they committed theft. So it seeks to increase it from like 300 to 750 or 1,000. Other states are like at 1,500, such as Texas and Georgia. And it seeks to do some other things, provide occupational license for individuals that are being released so that they could start earning a living wage and become part of the community and be given back and leading their families. So it seems like these are what some would call reform. And if you ask me, I think these reforms, overall, don't seem like reformist reform. There is some reformist reform in the fact that by increasing the threshold to $1,000, I am implicitly agreeing that it's not good to call someone a felon if they're stealing under $1,000. But once they steal over $1,000, then they are felons, right? Irrespective of their circumstances or what society and the community has done to fail these individuals to the point where they're stealing to survive. Right. And so it legitimizes the crime and the penal institution in many ways. So to that end, it is a reformist reform. Right. But at at large, it has many aspects that will keep people from the system. And hopefully, like I like to say, every time we abolish one prison bed, we're doing abolitionist work. If one person is not going back to prison and they're not being substituted with electronic monitoring in society, and they're having the autonomy and the independence to break away from the system in some respect, we're working towards abolition. However, that same bill on the tail end has a particular law that creates a new crime for individuals who use or possess a gift card that was the result of a fraudulent return. So to put this in perspective, someone steals $50 or an item worth $50, takes it back to the store, returns it, they get a $50 gift card, and now they use that $50 to buy groceries at Walmart in that store. And well, now they're third degree felons. Now they're felons for life, regardless of the fact that the amount that was stolen is only $50. And it was used to buy food, right?
You described abolition as like a compass, which I know I think of too. It's a goal that helps us like evaluate choices along the way. I think people also think that abolition is like, you know, burning everything down tomorrow and not necessarily incremental, which I know that I don't think that any of us in this room think is true. So I guess, what are like tangible non-reformist reforms, like incremental reforms that people who care about this work can be pushing for right now?
Yeah, absolutely. If it was just burning everything down, then we have Sherman and the Union soldiers doing that in the South, abolishing slavery and then leaving all the slaves to hang, right? And we would be no different than the Union North in our approach. So W.E. Du Bois talks about an abolitionist democracy, about erecting institutions that will then be able to empower the individual. So it's not just a negative breaking down of the harmful stuff, but it is the erecting of the humane and positive stuff that are necessary to rectify to restore those that have been oppressed as part of a system. And you know, this is just a thought that just came to me. We have a system that doesn't restore victims, right? Our penal system tends to focus on punishing, not necessarily so much as restoring the victims. At most, they'll give restitution to a victim imposed upon a defendant who probably would never have the deep pockets to pay it, so the restitution is never really true. But there's not a real concerted effort from the state to restore the victim. And ironically enough, on the individual level, there is the punishment, but not the restoration of the victim. And on a systemic level, even when slavery was abolished, there was a punishment of the South, but not a restoration of the newly freed slaves, right? And it seems to be that same paradigm. It's violence and punishment, but never an effort for restoration either, because that is too complicated, too difficult, or whatever the reason may be, or it doesn't promote power. But whatever the reason may be, there seems to be a parallel at the individual and at the systemic level of punishing, but not restoring those affected. So as what can be done incrementally, one of the things that I did with my piece is that I allowed the reader to see all the gaps in the system, and there's so many that one can become overwhelmed. But one can notice where one has a platform to be able to make a difference from, right? And so my call is to ask yourself, where do you stand and what space do you occupy that would allow you to use those resources you have to correct that problem in that space? And I think if we all did that collectively, we would be doing what abolitionists understand, which is a comprehensive effort at correcting the injustices of this legal society. And so I challenge individuals to do that. Now, if you were to ask me what is the one thing that is most important to me, and I was very comforted to find out that it was also the one thing that was very important to Angela Davis, is education. The power of education, apart from the economic mobility that it's supposed to create here in this country, it's the empowerment of the individual and the ability to think creatively, for new solutions, to see the value in themselves and then the humanity in others. So promoting and fighting for education at every level, from pre-K, K through 12, education within the prison systems, education once people get out. I'm a big believer in creating this idea of a prison to school pipeline. Not that the meritocracy of schools are any better, but it is one of the ways that humanity is able to find its self-actualization is through the autonomy of the mind. And so for me, is whatever way that you can promote education, and I mean education for the betterment of the community, of the children and those that are impacted, I think you'll be doing great work. But also, don't feel like you have to consume the entire elephant. Find out where in the space you occupy, you have resources to address one particular problem, and address that problem full-heartedly. It could be bail reform. It could be mentoring or helping children of incarcerated parents. It could be addressing food insecurity. It could be providing employment and never even seeing someone in a jail or touching anything that has to do with the legal system, but creating a sustainable wage for people getting out, teaching people how to code. This is the beautiful thing that a reformist reform would say, oh, we fixed one thing and the job is done. An abolitionist says, no, we have a long way to go, and burning down the building is far from it. We need to erect institutions that elevate and centralize the humanities of those that have been affected.
Right. You know, what you're saying, Angel, makes me think of a quote by James Forman Jr., professor at Yale, where he says that abolition is the idea that you imagine a world without prisons, and then you work to try to build that world. So it seems like that's what you're talking about here. And so I just want to take an opportunity to that point to bring us back to the first time CRCL spoke to you back in October, when you had a conversation about your fight for Florida's Amendment 4, which was trying to restore voting rights to people who had been convicted of a felony. I know there's been some updates with that. The amendment passed, and you were really involved with that effort. But I see here lately that Florida is trying to kind of go against that victory. Can you just speak very briefly about what's happening with Amendment 4 right now?
Let me just make this clear. We won last year. We won a historic win, and we undid a 150-year-old Jim Crow era, not law, a Jim Crow era constitutional provision in Florida's constitution. And that was done by the citizens of Florida. That is historic. And so what's happening now in the Florida legislature is essentially a sore loser's bill. They're trying to limit the win, but the win is there nonetheless. But in part, they're being successful, not in what they're actually passing, but in demoralizing a lot of the citizens in Florida to believe that they really have no political efficacy and autonomy in their state. And it's starting to make many individuals feel like this will be too long before it gets into the courts, and they feel defeated. And because of that, I believe these sore losers are achieving an intangible victory of demoralizing and getting individuals to now think that they have no political efficacy, and as such, don't become politically or continue being politically active. So let me just first say that we won. We've been able to do something historic. We're having record number registrations month to month of former individuals who were formerly incarcerated or formerly convicted of felonies. And so the legislators essentially right now are saying, well, the law says that you have to have completion of all terms of sentence, including parole and probation. How can we make this most restrictive as possible? And what they've decided to do is to say that all terms of sentence, even though it was not in the wording of the Constitution, it's going to include financial obligations. And it's going to include restitution, court costs, fees, and fines. And let me just say that as an organization that is led by formerly incarcerated individuals who themselves have been victims of crimes as well, we really support and stand side by side with victims of crime. So we want restitution to be a thing that individuals are able to get and that victims are made whole. What we don't believe is that voting rights should be restricted because of restitution. We think individuals should be able to do both. And in fact, the statistics tell us that people who are voting are less likely to recidivate and more likely to be employed. And that means that those individuals who are voting are also more likely to be paying back restitution. So we believe that it's helpful and beneficial for victims of crime who have restitution to have those who owe them restitution to be engaging their community, working, and paying back restitution as opposed to being disaffected, marginalized, and likely to return back to prison where no one is being paid and it becomes a cost on the state. So that's what's going on with the legislators. They're trying to create this, what has been correctly coined, a poll tax that allows individuals who've been similarly sentenced and similarly fined to not have similar access to voting based on the size of their wallet or their pocketbook. And so they have done that not only to say that if you have court costs, fines, and fees that are outstanding, you can't vote, but even after those things become civil obligations, meaning no longer part of the criminal sentence, they will continue serving as a bar on voting. Now, my big concern with this is not only the people that owe money, we're fighting for them because they're the most vulnerable in our community. They're the ones that are the poorest. But we're also fighting because I have many friends right now who have told me that they had their court costs waived many years ago, but they have no documents to prove it. And until they have something to prove it, they're not going to go register because the last thing they need is to get charged with perjury for fraudulently registering to vote and saying that they had no court costs when in fact they had something in collection somewhere that they had no clue about. And so it's a chilling effect that is being created. So I see this as a move by politicians who are really angry with citizens who continue to pass initiatives on things that are better for the state, and they are responding by then restricting it. The same thing happened a few years ago with legalizing medical marijuana in the state. It was done through a citizen initiative. It was put into the Constitution. The legislators came back and passed a law and said, yeah, that you can have, but not smokable medical marijuana, which the courts found to be unconstitutional. But by that time, people feel like, oh, I'm wasting my time. I should have never even fought so hard to get this on the ballot. So we're just here encouraging people not to forget that what the legislators are doing is a sore loser's move. They've already lost. They're just trying to limit their losses. And come 2020, we want to hold all legislators accountable and every candidate that comes through Florida accountable and ask them, what is their position on decarceration? What is their position on restoring voting rights? And it is from that perspective that we hope to push the envelope here in Florida. And we're very excited to see individuals throughout the country after Florida saying, no, not only should people who are in society and back in their communities be able to vote, but people in prison should never be disenfranchised to begin with. So we're very excited about the work that's happening over there in Massachusetts to allow individuals who are in prison the ability to vote and to join the rest of Western democracies who know that the right to vote is so sacred and the temptation to use it as a political tool is so real that not even people in prison should be stripped of their rights to vote.
Angel, your work and the work of the people you organize alongside with is like hugely inspiring, despite the hurdles the legislature's putting in y'all's way, and truly the reason that this conversation is even on the presidential stage at this point. So that is very much thanks to you, and y'all have really shown us that like organized people be organize money, and I know you'll continue to in 2020. One last question for you before we let you go. Your piece was titled In Spite of Prison, and among the many things prisons are built to deny people access to is a political or legal education, something that you've said and shown was hugely transformative for you. Aside from reading your piece in the Law Review, which every single one of our listeners should, could you maybe leave us off with one or two books that the people listening should read to learn more about this?
Mahro, first, I want to say thank you for those kind words about our work down here. But I would be remiss, and I would just want to elevate every single directly impacted person here in Florida, the families of those that are directly impacted, because it has been, and the victims that have stood alongside of us to make our state better, that it has been their work, and I've just been thankfully a part of that because I myself am directly impacted. But it has been this collective effort of people who society said were the evildoers, who society said were the scum of the earth, who society said deserved every punishment they got, that decided to allow love to trump over this punitive mentality and this hurtful experiences that we have had with the system, and decided to say, no, we want to be able to make our communities better, and we're going to move and lead this movement and not have others lead it for us. And in the process, not only have we done something historic, but we have been able to become friends and show people that we are just as normal. We're the neighbors, the fathers, the children, the uncles of our society, and it has demystified and taken away this illusion that those that have been are felons are somehow the evildoers. And I just want to thank every one of those individuals that have led, beginning with Desmond Mead, who started this almost over 10 years ago when anyone else would have told you this was impossible. And in fact, the money showed it because no one funded him, and we did this all on a grassroots with a grassroots effort. So I just wanted to highlight them, because I just been privileged to be a part of it. And with respect to a piece or a book or two to read, there's a book that inspired, in a way inspired me, but in another way, I'm a big believer in stories. I think that's the other reason that I was thankful that I gathered the courage and had a mentor who introduced me to enough literature to make my piece with the Harvard Law Review, arguably, probably will be the most celebrated piece that I ever write. And I was able to write it in a way that communicated my story with my words. And so it was Righting My Wrongs by Shaka Singhor. When he wrote his, there were moments in his journey where he became so vulnerable, but that I also identified that I was in that vulnerable situation, but had never been public about it. And hearing him be public about these vulnerable, embarrassing, sad moments of his life and of his decisions gave me enough courage to reach out to him and tell him, I have never been public about that. And thanks to your courage of being public about it, I now am courageous enough, at least a little more, to speak a little more about things like that. So thank you for that. And so that piece played a role in giving me the courage to write my piece almost 2 years later. So I think it deserves mentioning. And another one that is very inspirational, particularly for individuals that find themselves in academic institutions and want to and have gone to these institutions to make sure that they represent their families and their communities and hope to make a change. I think Just Mercy by Bryan Stevenson is another one that has given me hope sometimes when we get to these academic settings where we're told to suppress our personalized voice and to forget where we come from and just remember that you're lucky to be here and here's the track given to you, particularly if you're in law school. You either big law or public interest and be quiet about the rest. Reading his story and realizing that he struggled with the same things and seeing the impact he has had in just helping juveniles find some dignity before the Supreme Court, something that many of us in law school have come to become very pessimistic about, has been very encouraging. So those are two works, but as far as abolition goes, obviously is the classic Are Prisons Obsolete by Angela Davis.
Well, thank you so much for those recommendations and also for taking the time out. I know it's your finals week, so we're really grateful to you for taking the time to just share a little bit of your story and your insight with our listeners. As always, we learn so much every time you speak. So thank you, Angel.
Oh, it's been truly a pleasure, and I can't wait to see some of the work that you all are going to continue doing there at Harvard and around the community in Cambridge and beyond.
So Dr. Cynthia Boyer lectures in U.S. Constitutional Law at University of Toulouse Capital and in American Studies at the Institut National University Champollion in France. She holds a PhD in political science and is currently a Fulbright Scholar in U.S. politics and law. Her field of research includes the intersection of U.S. politics and American constitutional law, and she has recently published on how we should understand American jurisprudence, especially during the Trump era. In her new research, Dr. Boyer traces how race is intrinsically linked to the founding of the U.S. and how this foundation of domination remains the essence of the American institutional system. Though cases like Brown v. Board of Education and Reynolds v. Sims ended legal segregation, they were characteristic of a shift to the treatment of inequality in the U.S. One example of this shift is seen in the death penalty. Dr. Boyer argues that the advent of neoliberalism in the 1970s, which has since become a policy of government, had a significant impact on the consideration of the individual in the criminal state. She specifically focuses on the harmful impact of the case Lockett v. Ohio, which took place within this neoliberalist context. She argues that Lockett v. Ohio set the stage for a focus on the individual, while ignoring long-held societal and institutional prejudices, and that this has brought a new and harmful rationale to death penalty jurisprudence. So, Dr. Boyer, can we first start with a description of neoliberalism, and how do we connect this with U.S. jurisprudence?
Yes, sure. Well, first of all, I would like to say that neither the American Supreme Court nor Congress has been willing to take direct action to prevent racial factors from influencing which defendants are sentenced to death for capital crimes. And the American former U.S. Supreme Court Justice William Brennan said of the death penalty that it smacks of little more than the lottery system. And this element is deeply connected to the concept of neoliberalism. Well, neoliberalism was crafted by the Society of Mont Pèlerin, and it was founded by Frederick Hayek, and it's still today frequented by the most ardent defenders of neoliberalism. And it's based on a triptych which is composed of an ideology, because neoliberalism is a moral code which aims to establish rules of life that must follow individuals, the adherence to anybody of ideas which has consequences in the individual life. And it also rests on the institutions, so it's favorable to a certain type of institution, in particular based on a model reflecting the market mechanisms. And also, therefore, it's not a question of absenting from state intervention, but trying to construct an intervention that is going to favor the market. So the major objective of neoliberalism is to liberate individual freedom, and that's something which appeared in the United States in the current of the 1970s, and it came to the age when Ronald Reagan was elected American president. And at the same time in Europe, Margaret Thatcher also implemented this concept in the entire British society. So it's a concept which has a different approach in the United States than it has in other countries. It's, in other words, it means a very conservative approach. And from a legal point of view, and I'm going to quote Bruce Ackerman, it's not about neoliberalism versus liberalism. It's indeed neoliberalism versus the conservative approach. So this word sometimes might be quite disturbing in American politics and in the American legal studies, because in the United States the word liberal has a totally different meaning. But we've got to go back to the roots. Up to the 1930s, the word liberal meant the same thing in Europe, in the rest of the world, and in the United States. And it meant an approach based on individual rights. And it meant access to greater market. And then Roosevelt, in order to make sure that the majority of people were going to agree with state intervention into the economy, so basically the New Deal, he campaigned in order to make this change in the meaning of liberalism. Mm. So that's the reason why neoliberalism, it's about the market, and that's liberal in American terms, which has another meaning.
So can you explain how that took shape in Lockett v. Ohio?
Yes, sure. So in the 1970s, there was this problem related to the arbitrary power and especially the arbitrary aspect of death sentencing. And you know that the American Supreme Court suspended death penalty for several years because there was this great problem among the American states about the way to deal with death penalty cases. And Lockett emerged at a time when the American Supreme Court justices wanted to center the discussion, wanted to focus the discussion on individuals. And Sandra Lockett was the most perfect candidate for this new trend in American jurisprudence. The reason why it's because Sandra Lockett, who gave the name to the case, she didn't she didn't kill anybody. She didn't physically take part in a murder. And she was still sentenced to death penalty for having been part of something, of an event which was going to lead to the murder of a person. But she was not physically present on the crime. She was not an accessory for the crime. And therefore, she was a perfect person in order to establish mitigating factor. And that's something which came out from Lockett versus Ohio. That's the fact that the American Supreme Court started to take into account one's personality, one's background, one's education, and all the individual aspects, they took shape and they were reinforced by the other cases that followed Lockett versus Ohio, and especially Eddings and then Skipper versus South Carolina. And also Grams versus Collins and also Hitchcock versus Duggar and Parker versus Duggar.
So how do we understand what influence this has on communities of color and further death penalty jurisprudence, and how does that interact with the critical race theory?
The reason why this case is fundamental and all the jurisprudence is fundamental, it's the fact that by focusing on individuals instead of focusing on society, it has given more importance to internal factors, I was saying one's background and one's experience, but discrimination has totally been neglected by the American Supreme Court following this case. And that's the reason why, for example, in 1993, in the case Grams versus Collins, Clarence Thomas departed in his opinion, and he clearly stated that all the rationale behind Furman versus Georgia has totally been forgotten by the Lockett jurisprudence and all the discrimination that black people have experienced in the United States. Because the society does not, nowadays, the American Supreme Court and state courts, for the majority of them, they don't take into account the discrimination that is part of all the elements which lead to the death sentence.
So what would the alternative model be that would be beneficial to criminal law?
You mean the solutions?
Right.
Very hard to find the solutions. First of all, the American Supreme Court should tackle this issue because it has refused so far to consider discrimination as an element in death penalty cases, and more precisely in the case McClesley versus Kemp in 1987. The American Supreme Court refused to consider the data and all the statistics which were given, because death penalty, and we have to remember it, it's something which belongs to state sovereignty. But even though at the federal level, there has been this lack of consideration for taking account all the discrimination that are part of the sentence. So a solution could be to try to define all the elements which form the outcome of death penalty. That is to say, electoral accountability really matters, because all the death sentences are are done by a few number of districts in the United States.
Right.
So the majority of districts, they don't apply death penalty, but the districts where death penalty is applied are controlled by white majority. So taking into account electoral accountability of prosecutors, of judges, members of the jury as well, because even though there was this case from the Supreme Court that said that it was impossible to prohibit somebody from being part of a jury because of one's race. It has not really been applied because other elements have been found in order to refuse somebody from being a member of the jury, like somebody wears glasses, somebody lived in a certain place, so, or somebody single, or somebody is married. So if you want to refuse a member of the jury, you can avoid race for consideration, but you can use other perspectives. The prosecution, electoral accountability, and the jury, cross-racial identification as well really matters. Because it gives elements to the sentence. So I think that it should be very interesting for the criminal system to start to really consider this through the critical race theory approach, because that's something which affects the life of all the American people. We're not saying that people should become free by not continuing death penalty like this. No, because these persons are guilty. But there is something which really matters. It's no arbitrary aspects in the sentence.
It strikes me that there seem to be two possible approaches to reform here. One, thinking about the application of the criminal law. Second, thinking about the foundational aspects of the criminal law. In thinking about the application of the criminal law, we see some reforms, not at the death penalty level, but at the bail assessment level, for example. We have these risk assessment tools that are coming out, algorithms, and there's a sense of this being a neoliberal reform in the sense that it's better than what we have, but it might actually just be entrenching the deeply racist systems that we do have now. I'd love for you to speak a little bit about how we can avoid the pitfalls of thinking we are moving towards reform, but really just entrenching the racism that we have now in our criminal law.
I think that, yes, there is an improvement, but, between 1930 and 1970, 85 of those who were executed under federal law, they were white people, and 9% were black. So the situation reversed. So there have been some improvements in the system, in the approach of the system, but still there is this discrimination that affects black people in the entire American judiciary. So,
and how do we get around this problem? Because I think we're at the place right now where the courts don't want to accept empirical data about who is being impacted by the criminal justice system and how they're being impacted. How do we get around that? What kinds of arguments should we be making to make sure that the real discrimination in the death penalty is brought to the fore?
I think it should be done at the state level. So trying to campaign at the local level, because that's the way the American institutions they work. So by trying to educate to this issue, by trying to campaign with the state legislatures, it should work in order to make people aware of this great discrimination that affects everybody. Because the people who are directly affected are black people. But the entire country is affected, because in a country where you don't have a fair system, where you have this great problem and this big discrimination, everybody is affected. So trying to campaign at the state level, probably, and trying to research further on all the elements, because that's something which needs to be deeply understood in order to find solutions. So I don't have solutions. What I'm seeing is the fact that there is this problem, and my article and my work is very factual. And I think it's up to the American people to realize that this problem exists, and the society should improve. So there is no society which is perfect in all the countries. But the United States has this great approach of trying to improve itself and trying to find solutions whenever there is a problem. And here we've got a big problem.
And so as the problem, as I understand it, is neoliberalism has made jurisprudence focus more on individual characteristics and leave behind deeply entrenched prejudice and societal factors that led criminals to where they are or defendants to where they are, and that this has only been pushed further by issues with popular sovereignty. Is that what you're – so could you tell us more about?
Yeah, because there have been many researches conducted saying that neoliberalism really has created a new approach of colonialism at the international level with globalization, but also at the national level by recreating a hierarchy of classes. And it has affected all the levels of the judiciary. And especially in criminal law. And why it really matters in criminal law, because we're talking about death and life. So there is no solution. I mean, if a death sentence is applied and it's not applied in a very sensible way, you've got no way to come back to the issue. So this trend has really affected and still affects nowadays all the societies. And as I was saying, there is this new colonialism, which is deeply important. That's right. That criminals are criminals because they've got their freedom to be criminals. What I mean is the fact that not everybody is going to be a criminal, and you don't become a criminal because you were born in a poor area. It's not a good reason. I mean, it's what I want to say is the fact that everybody has his own responsibility, but the society itself. And especially the American society created a system of slavery. We're not talking a system of discrimination among classes. We're talking a system where people were masters and the other persons were slaves. So after slavery, there was segregation, as you know, and there has only been one generation since the end of segregation. So that's the reason why this is still a very burning issue in
I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about sort of the political moments that we might need. So, for example, you talked about the Furman versus Georgia decision, and I think that's the closest that the courts have come to striking down the death penalty. And there did seem to be a somewhat of a national consensus at that time, as much as there ever has been, that maybe the death penalty is bad. And we've definitely backed away from that, and I don't see the neoliberalism critique of the death penalty getting us back towards the abolition of the death penalty. And I'm wondering if you could speak a little bit about the factors that have prevented us from moving in that direction.
Well, that's Craig versus Georgia, which came just after Furman, mm-hmm. Which really changed the system. And the problem in the ruling of the death penalty is the fact that the American Supreme Court has to face a big challenge, which is state sovereignty. So not interfering into state sovereignty, because death penalty belongs to the state's discretionary power. So that's the reason why by the end of the 1970s there was this new approach which was going to guide the American Supreme Court justices. And in the early 1980s, and under Ronald Reagan, new justices were appointed, and they brought some power to the previous to the approach which came by the end of the 1970s. So Sandra O'Connor, Antonin Scalia, and Rehnquist, and the Rehnquist Court, they transformed the Warren Court and its previous approach. So that's something that really had an impact. And then even though among these Supreme Court justices, you don't have the same approach. I mean, they are not guided by this neoliberalism. They are inspired by neoliberalism, but there are some issues which have to be taken into account when they wrote their opinions and when they rule on the case. But neoliberalism really has affected them indirectly or directly. But the problem about death penalty is the fact that it belongs to each state.
Yeah, you talk about the role of the tyranny of the majority and its impact on the death penalty. Could you tell us more about that?
Yes, sure. Tyranny of the majority because the majority of people in the United States are white people, so they are more represented in the institutions. Judges are, for the majority of them, white people. Same thing for the prosecution. Same thing for members of the juries. So I'm not going to say that they are tyrant, but they are tyrant for the minorities. And as they are more represented, it's more difficult for somebody who belongs to minority to be very, very free and to be very at ease when it comes to preempt the judicial system.
What do you see as the power of the critical race theory going forward, especially when it comes to death penalty jurisprudence?
I think it really needs to emerge more than before because the issue still remains. And I think it needs to spread into all different fields and all different aspects, not only in law but also in politics, because we were referring to the tyranny of the majority. Well, prosecutors and judges are not tyrants. They've got to be re-elected or to be elected.
Right.
And when they're elected, they've got to be re-elected. So in a certain way, they are going to please and they are going to try to satisfy their electorate, even though they are not going to do it directly. But in their minds, they've got this big challenge. So if the electorate considers that a crime is a serious issue, crime is often connected in stereotypes to black people, and therefore, in order to satisfy their local electorate, they are going to focus on death penalty. And the concept of judicial override is very present in some states, even though it's no longer allowed by the American Supreme Court. It doesn't have a retroactive effect. So therefore, all the cases which appeared prior to the court's decision can be concerned by judicial override. And that's something which is very important because that's a concept of the tyranny of the majority and the sovereignty, because a judge can decide to go against a jury in a court's decision.
Wow.
In order to satisfy, for example, a local electorate composed for the majority of the voters, not necessarily the majority of the population, but the majority of the voters, because the voting rate is higher among white people than it is among minorities. So to satisfy them, he may or she may decide to use his or her judicial override. So it's a big issue.
To add on to that quickly, especially because critical race theory was born in universities, and I think the tendency is to see a very top-down approach of let's get at lawyers and judges and politicians, especially in this day and age when we know about rampant disenfranchisement of black and brown communities, when we know that there are great organizing efforts. We see that especially in states like Mississippi that haven't been able to get the electoral outcomes they want but are definitely doing a lot of organizing on the ground. What relevance can critical race theory have for those communities? How can we make sure that there's a dialogue between the researchers at universities and the local movement building efforts?
I think from the top top down is great, but it should go the other way, that it should down to the top at the same time. I mean, Martin Luther King campaigned at the local level in order to make the situation improve. So I think that minorities should start to try to find solutions by themselves with the help of critical race theorists. And in a common effort to improve the common situation for the common good, basically. So researching is great, but applying research is really the most important aspect.
Well, thank you so much. That was very interesting.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If you want to have an alternative ending, we can ask, like, where your research is going after this. Do you want to, we could cut this part out, but...
Okay, yeah, I've got to think about the answer.
Okay.
Okay.
Or is there anything else you'd want us to ask?
No, it's up to you. Up to you, yeah.
Do you think it is possible for critical race theorists to connect with communities?
Yeah, sure, because they're part of all the communities, so right. There are people who live in their own communities, so yes, sure, of course, yeah. And I think that's the most important thing, to connect, to really connect, and it means campaigning. It means to spread this theory at all the levels. Society, politics really matter. It really matters. And therefore to be more connected to minorities and the majority, because the majority is not a bad majority. It's just that it needs to face these issues needs to be faced by everybody, majority and minority, together, hand in hand, for the common good.
What's kept it from doing so far?
Well, I think that by focusing on individuals, there was this feeling of equality, which was going to be more important in the ruling and in the sentencing. But it should work if the society was perfect. But the society has been affected by segregation and by slavery.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, when one is born, one does not have the same chances depending on where the person was born in the background. So, because you don't have the same start, this start has to be taken into account.
Do you think, has the Trump administration's policies changed your research in any way?
In a certain way, yeah, because especially regarding immigration, it has emphasized the concept of state sovereignty and federal power. So you've got this big challenge between federal institutions and especially law enforcement at the local level, and the fact that some states have followed the guidelines from the federal government and others have refused to do so, and especially regarding immigration and ICE, ICE warrants. So it has been challenging. It has been challenging, but the previous administration was also challenging in many ways. So the Trump administration is not different. It's an ordinary presidency in the American history.
And to speak to the parallel that we've seen in the Trump era, we've also seen a focus on, for those on the left, on thinking about state sovereignty in opposition to the federal government. You see it with the sanctuary cities policies, for example. Do you see that as potentially detrimental when we think about the fact that state sovereignty was originally, especially with folks like Rehnquist, O'Connor, used for the individual rights conceptions?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. Yeah, I think you're right. That was something that was used in order to focus on individuals. But it has always been part of the debate in American politics and American law, straight from the start, straight from the drafting of the American Constitution, states versus federal power.
I think one of the challenges for critical race theory now, and I think we're starting to see it in the death penalty work with LGBT communities as well, is thinking about how we can make it as intersectional as possible. I think for a long time the movement was focused on race, and probably most specifically in the U.S. context and on white and black peoples. How do researchers need to move now to really understand these various forms of identity, race, at the intersection of gender, sexuality, et cetera, to make sure that we really are understanding the power dynamics in our communities?
You're absolutely right, saying that they need to connect, because a person is made of different identities. So one person can be black, but also can be gay, can be socially affected by some particular concerns. So it would be useless to tackle only one aspect of one's personality. For example, a black woman is black and she's also a woman. So she's affected by discrimination because she's black. She's also affected by discrimination because she is a woman. And if one considers her just only as a black person or only as a woman, then we are losing a point. So that's very important to try to connect all the identities and all the problems together in order to find solutions. Or to try to improve the situation.
Do you see that work becoming, or at least at being affected at all by the change in the population demographics as the U.S. moves from a majority white community to a majority, quote, minority community, where those identities are technically the greater part of the nation? Do you think that it becomes easier for critical race theory, or do you think it becomes more challenging for researchers to tackle all forms of identity?
They are becoming more important in terms of population, but are they becoming more influenced? That's another issue. What is necessary to look at is the situation of the Congress and the representatives. Just paying attention to representatives from minorities. And that's always in legislatures that you've got an idea of how the society works. If minorities are represented to the same level that they have in the society, so 15% for Latinos in America, 11% for black people, or if you have a number which is lower, it gives you an idea about equality in a society.
Right, and that goes back to the majority white judges discussions. The problem remains despite having a majority minority population.
And same thing for the majority of judges are men, so
right.
So it has an impact on women and on their on the way they rule cases, and especially reproductive rights, because they are white men. So it's not only one type of minority, but all the minorities are in the societies which are affected by this model of white Anglo-Saxon Protestant people being at the top of the institutions.
And of course, given that this is an issue of state sovereignty, what we see is that our more to the left states have gotten rid of the death penalty or are getting rid of the death penalty. And then we have our states like Alabama, where it's extremely entrenched. And then when you factor in both the law and politics pieces, it seems that change is nearly impossible right now. And I'm wondering, what do you think lessons from the past might be, or what can we take away from this and find any hope in the situation?
Well, it's state sovereignty because the Supreme Court refuses to consider it as a federal matter. It would be very easy. The American Supreme Court, the American institution is very flexible and its interpretation is very easy to change. So the Supreme Court has refused so far to consider it as a federal matter.
Okay, well, thank you so much. Enjoy the conference, and thank you so much for dropping by to talk to us.
Thank you very much.